My name is Liz, and I am Liz E., and I am a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous and Codependents Anonymous. Hi, everybody, and I've spent a great deal of time in another 12-step program called Al-Anon. And so, like my husband, Joey, I'm Lizzie, he's Joey, which are our childhood names, by the way, Lizzie and Joey. According to Joey, I'm overqualified, but I am still going to qualify today for you. So just a second. My prop. This is my big book. It's 35 years old. Actually, it's about 37 years old, but it sat in my house for about a year and a half as a coaster for my wine. Get to that. And I normally don't bring props. I just was feeling kind of fun because we're back at the Alano Club, and I just want to appreciate Joe for reminding John, and John for asking me to be here. But anyone who's ever been to my house, and a lot of you have probably sat down on the toilet in my downstairs bathroom and seen this. Probably didn't know what it was. This is the 12 Principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that was given to me at a Christmas party in 1985. And 9 months later, I got sober. And I put it there because when I'm full of shit, that's what I need to look at. So we'll talk about that in a minute. I figure that's probably true for everybody else. I'll try to clean it up. I actually am kind of a class act when I want to be. Like I said, my name's Liz E. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I'm a codependent in recovery, and I'm going to share my story, my experience, strength, and hope. That's what we do here today. And I'm going to come from my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. My sobriety date is October 13th, 1986. And my CODA anniversary was sometime between 2006 and 2007. When I bottomed out after trying to heal one of our children from alcoholism and drug addiction with a art therapy program, basically. I had a garage full of things from Michael's that just didn't seem to get her clean and sober. I don't know why that didn't work. But anyway, so I ended up in Al-Anon, and then when she got better and I didn't, I found myself in CODA, and that was, for me, probably one of the biggest shifts in my recovery. So I'm going to share the whole good, bad, and the ugly with you. I'm going to start where I think this disease starts, for me at least, and that is at the family. Two drinking fisted woman, nothing's changed. Okay. This one first with a chaser of coffee, water and coffee. My 3 out of 4 of my grandparents died from alcoholism.
Could you? Yeah. Go a little louder?
Sure.
We're having a hard time back here.
I absolutely can do that. Some of you know that I have a talent for doing that, actually.
Thank you.
3 out of 4 of my grandparents died from the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. And the other one, I'm not sure, I think she died from stress. And why that's important and why I bring that up is because alcoholism, addiction, all of its forms, is a family disease. The clinical people will tell us it's a behavioral health disorder. And what I've learned about behavioral health disorders is I got a thinking problem that leads to an emotional problem that leads to a behavioral problem, and they help you clean that up out there. And here, I don't have a drinking problem, I have a thinking problem. That's what y'all told me. So I'm going to be talking a lot about that as well. So 3 out of 4 of my grandparents had alcoholism. And all I knew about that growing up in my family was that my grandfather on my mom's side was the town drunk of Bodega Bay, had worked on all the bay bridges, was an iron worker, but somehow ended up dying of some kind of liver disease in the town drunk of Bodega Bay, and had actually drank away the property that the family owned, the bodega head, which is, would probably be worth millions of dollars now, but he drank it away. And that my mom had a big resentment about that, because the people who carried a 50-year bar tab from him knew exactly what they were doing, and she resented them, not him. My dad's dad burned the house down when he was 16. My dad was 16, his youngest brother was 2 years old, and killed the youngest kid in that family. Uh-huh. And the whole family was dispersed throughout California. My father ended up in, He ended up up in the Sierra Nevadas from Los Angeles with his aunt and uncle, and that's how I ended up being born and raised up in Plymouth County. Some of you guys who go to the men's retreat have been to Gray Eagle. I was born and raised up in that area and went to high school in Portola, and I lived right in Blairston. So some of you guys have had pizza there at the little tiny Pizza Hut. Anyway, tiny little small towns. And by the time I came on the scene, I'm the middle of nine kids, and I always say I'm an artist, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm the middle of nine kids, so no wonder I have issues, right? So what happened was I didn't know what alcoholism was. I thought alcoholism was the old man that burnt down the family house and my dad's still pissed and won't let you talk about his dad, or it's the guy who lost the family land, valuable family land, to the bar tab up in Bodega Bay. That's what I thought an alcoholic was, and I didn't know I had alcoholism. Didn't know it, but I had alcoholism before I ever took a drink, because I remember taking those first drinks and feeling that thing that kept me wanting to do it. So I was developing alcoholism before I ever took the first drink. I know that now. I didn't know that then. So what happened was, I grew up in a big family, nine kids, middle of that mess, and my parents found food, rage, and religion, and that's what I was raised with. And I took that as the normal life, and what it really was a bunch of untreated alcoholism passed down generationally. This all makes sense in my recovery. I didn't know any of it in my drinking. I didn't know any of it before I got to these rooms. So what happened was being lost in that middle of that big family, I all of a sudden kind of showed this talent out of nowhere. When I was about 13 years old, I started writing music. I had no music lessons. I just started writing songs that people thought were good, and I sounded like I could sing. And I started singing, and by the time I was 16, I was winning California State Honors Awards for my voice and my abilities in music. And I ended up, I was the lead in the school play. I was a cheerleader. I was a B student because I was like super social. It's like, you know, that studying thing took too much work. And I was a pretty promising young lady. I had a voice. People recognized it. I won an international jazz festival that year. 16 years old. Got out at all kinds of school because I was special, right? And so by the time I was 17, I ran off with my drug dealer boyfriend, not because I liked him, but because he could buy. I was a high school dropout. I had suicidal ideation, which I didn't even know that was a thing. I just felt like if it gets really bad, I'll kill myself. That was my solution. So 16 to 17 and a half years old, what changed? Alcohol and drugs. I found alcohol and drugs, and it fixed all that stuff I was carrying around inside. I bottomed out I lived somewhere down in the Saratoga Mountains, hills, and I had never been there. Don't even remember going there. I was so loaded every day for about a year with this crazy guy, and my family didn't know where I was, and then my sister found me because my grandmother had died, so they all ganged up on me and brought me home against my will, but okay, I didn't really have a will left. I just was, whatever the drug or alcohol was, I just lived in this place of reaction, and give me alcohol and drugs. That was it. I dropped out of high school, didn't even remember making that decision. So I'm a blackout drinker, but I didn't even know I had alcoholism because, see, an alcoholic is a guy who burns a house down and loses the family property his bar bill. Had no idea I had alcoholism. I just thought I was bad. And I had a family who wanted to tell me how bad I was. So I believe that. I feel it coming on. Got the tissues. I'm looking at Kathleen. Kathleen and I have been going to meetings for 30-something years, and we sympathetically cry together. Anyway, so stop that, Kathleen, because it's affecting me over here. I got to talk, girl. So I came home, and I got good. And I went to church for like 9 months, and I didn't drink. Now, here's what's interesting about that. I knew there was something up with the drinking because I quit to get good. And it worked. I went to high school at the continuation high school in the morning, and I went to the college at night. And the college and the high school, the continuation high school, were literally a quarter of a mile from each other on the same road up in Quincy. Some of you guys have probably been to a men's meeting or a meeting when you go to the men's retreat. Where I went to my continuation high school, that's the same, very same room I got my education, high school diploma. And at that high school, I was better than all these 16-year-olds who were smoking cigarettes and they were such losers. Look what I did when I was 16 in high school. Way better than all of you. Got down the quarter of a mile and I'd look around to all the kids I was supposed to have graduated with who are now at this junior college, and I'm not telling them anything about where I've been. They want to know, but I'm not giving up my information because I'm less than. I can go from better than to less than in a quarter of a mile. That's the alcoholic mind I have. So I stayed sober for 9 months, and then my mom told me to get a job, so I got a job at a bar, and I was drunk that first night. But I had already discovered a really important tool, and that's called overcompensating behavior and diet pills. And overcompensating behavior, go get that high school diploma out here. Go get that college good grade out here. Take those diet pills so you can stay up all night and get those grades. And oh, by the way, it was helping me out with my low self-esteem around my body weight and all that. So I had a lot of stuff around that. Still working on that one today. So I went from being a daily drinker, blackout drinker, to a periodic drinker. Now, I didn't know what that was until I got here. Your book talks about it. The book says, Dr. Silkworth's doctor's opinion tells me all about the periodic. I became a periodic because I still wanted to feel good about myself, so I became a human doing, trying to fix that inside with something outside of myself. But you can only do that for so long before you need a drink. Then I gave myself permission to drink, go into the blackout, get some relief, come back out, go back to the overcompensating behavior. And I did that for the next 4 to 5 years with bouts of suicidal ideation. And I didn't know I had alcoholism. Because an alcoholic is a guy who burns down the house and loses the land and embarrasses the family. So I started hanging out with this guy, some of you know, and I was so worried that he was a religious freak because he wouldn't drink, and I drank. And I was, you know, I remember meeting him because I was in the overcompensating mode, so I'm conscious for this part. And I'm thinking, and I was so relieved when he told me he was an alcoholic. Oh God, he's not one of those like religious freaks that's gonna tell me what a bad person I am. I mean, I'm relieved he's an alcoholic. That made sense to me. I was like, okay, I like this guy. This works for me. And he's going to these meetings, and his ex-girlfriend goes to these meetings. And I got to let her know I'm here. So I go to Al-Anon, because it's down the hall from AA, to let her know he's got a new girlfriend, lady. So that's how I got to my first meeting, and it was an Al-Anon meeting. Those poor, patient, beautiful Al-Anon people. Anyway, so I went to a few of those, thought up some bullshit that I could blame on him, tell, you know, woe is me story, and then I told them all how to do it, how to deal with it, because by that point, I was a wine connoisseur with bad taste in men, and I moved from victim to survivor. So I knew a thing or two about a thing or two. I was going to tell those ladies what was up. So I did, and they were patient and they listened and then thank you very much and moved on to the next person. And I was like, So I didn't really, I kind of got the vibe from them. And so I left. I'd made my point. And he started getting better. I always say Joe was coming up out of the gutter while I was going down because we have a progressive illness. But I didn't know I had alcoholism. I thought, this is great for these people. And I just kept doing what I was doing. It was working for me. And if it was still working for me, I'd still be doing it. Because I was thin, and I was achieving shit, and I was feeding my ego constantly, and it was working for me, and I got to drink. Problem with me is I drink into a blackout. And the last time I drank was on October 13th. So, well, actually, I started drinking on a Thursday, and I woke up, I came to on a Sunday afternoon. And I had a 10-minute marriage that resulted in a child somewhere in that 5 years. And I didn't know where my kid was. And all my enablers were kind of done with me. And I remember driving from Quincy, where I'd been partying for 4 or 5 days with some of my old party buddies, back down to Chico, and I was failing fine. I couldn't do the overachieving thing as much because my drinking periods were getting longer. And it wasn't working, and I was getting paranoid, and I was having a hard time remembering things. And I was feeling terrible about myself. And I had been I'd done all kinds of things during that time. You know, I'd learned to drive by Braille. I'd go out and party all night, and then come home and drive the babysitter home, and leave my kid in the house by itself, and have to make that decision drunk, and get away with it. And never think about that again until I did a fourth step in this room or in these rooms. That's the kind of stuff I was doing. But I never thought about it until the crisis was over. And I lived in constant crisis and reaction. But I thought I was doing okay. And I didn't know I had alcoholism because an alcoholic is a guy who burns down the house and loses the property and embarrasses the family. And religion will fix that. Because it did for my parents. And it didn't work for me. Religion didn't work for me. So I just figured I was probably some kind of a manic depressive. That's what I thought. And they probably had a drug for that. So I was holding out for that. Okay. But then I found out that you can't drink with those drugs. And so I said, no, that's not me. So on October 13th, 1986, my worst day turned out to be my best day, but I didn't know it yet. And what happened was I was driving down the Feather River Canyon, a beautiful place, driven down many, many times in my life. I lived up there. Thank you, Kathleen. And driving down the canyon and I'm bitching about everybody in my mind. They don't get it. They don't understand. I'm the one that's the victim here. Everybody's picking on me. Wham, wham, wham. It's his fault. And this little voice came in my head and said, maybe you're an alcoholic. I couldn't shake it. Because I'd been here. I had been here. And I thought, oh, this is great for these people. But I'm not one of them. I'd sat in these rooms and I'd gotten to know them. And it wasn't me. So I thought, well, I'm going to go home and I'm just going to get good. And getting good meant like, you know, church-like and all that kind of stuff. Although not actually going to church because that's too much of a commitment. And but thinking, like, I'm going to think church-like. And so what happened was I didn't have the money to get my furniture out of storage. It was the end of the summer, moving into the new school year. And I was having trouble with money, go figure. And I didn't have any. That was the problem. And all my stuff was in storage except for a few boxes. And I sat down on the green shag carpet of my lovely Menlo Way apartment in Chico, California. And I started undoing this couple little boxes I had, and there was my book. This one right here. And I sat down and started reading it, because maybe I'm an alcoholic. Maybe that's what this is. And there was some relief in that thought. Maybe that's what's wrong with me. because I knew something was wrong with me. On some level, I knew something was wrong with me. So 30 days into this, I was having full-blown anxiety attacks, and this friend of mine came over, and she wasn't an alcoholic, but she was some kind of a social worker major in college, and she dragged me to my first AA meeting for me. And they were doing that 30 days thing with the chips at the front of the room, and I had forgotten about that part because I was probably, you know, half-baked when I went there the couple times I did. And I said, I got 30 days because I had been counting, and I was having so much anxiety. And they made me come up to the front of the room, and I said, I'm Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. Didn't plan on saying that, but I knew it was true. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I didn't believe in God, so that's pretty amazing. But he believed in me. And I took that tiny step, and he met me right there. I can't talk about that without crying, because I am so grateful for that moment. That was grace. I was an atheist. Then I found out how much faith you have to be an atheist. I decided I was agnostic because I got a chapter for that. And so I went to these darn meetings, and I was going, and I was going at night because all these people were frickin' ancient. You know, those really old people in their 30s and 40s. 50s and 60s, and I was like, oh my God. And there was this woman that ran around town, and she had a braid down to the floor, and she wrapped it around her head like she thought she was Cleopatra, and she rode a tricycle around Chico. And I was like, oh my God, that woman's in here? Oh, stay away. She became my sponsor. Because I would always try to get out before the Lord's Prayer and the candlelight me, and she'd catch me right at the door. And I said, the God stuff, I don't do the God stuff. And she grabbed my hand, and she said, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You don't have to do the God stuff. She recognized that that word could keep me out. I don't care what you call it. It's a word. Words are powerful. Find one that works for you. That's what they're talking about. Find something that works for you. That's not you. Because I don't have a drinking problem, I have a thinking problem. And I can't fix the head I got with the head I got. So I started going to these meetings, and this lady drives a tricycle, so she needs rides everywhere. So now I know why she cornered me. She needs rides. And I'm too codependent to say no, because she might not like me, even though I can't stand her. So I start taking her to these meetings, and she sponsors all these frickin' people. So we're picking up 20 people as we're going. It's like crazy. So I end up in this middle of this group of people, these women, in new sobriety, and I start getting it. And I get concepts like this. All you gotta do is be self-honest. You don't have to be honest about every single thing. You start with self-honesty. Start with the willingness to be self-honest. The reason I brought this tonight is because the easiest way for me to talk about the steps and how they worked in my life is to talk about the principles of this program. And if you're new, I love the fellowship, but the fellowship is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. These 12 steps are what will change your life. You can come here and get a lot by osmosis, but you're not going to change enough to probably stay sober. That's my opinion. I know it wouldn't have worked for me. I had to get down to the causes and conditions of my illness. And this is the path I took, and the path that's recommended in the chapter, How It Works. And the results of the steps result in these principles. The first step says, I'm thinking about the principle, not the step. I'm totally blanking. That's crazy. I'll stick with the principle. I went from honesty and dishonesty to willingness and awareness. I went out of denial. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless. I am not going to get out of that until I acknowledge that. That first principle is honesty. If I can't do that and put those two pieces of the step together, I can't be honest enough to stay sober. That's what I found out. Powerless, unmanageable. That takes tremendous honesty when my one and only coping mechanism for most of my problems is to drink and blame others. Step two, I'm hopeless. Step two takes me to hope. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Hopeless. Step two gives me the hope. 180 degree turn. Step three, became willing to make, I'm totally blanking today, sorry.
Made a decision
to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand God. There's that word. I had to come up with a working definition. First of all, I had to make a decision. I had been unwilling. Now I got to get willing to make a decision. Decision means to cut off from going this way. Now I'm going to go this way. I'm going to do it different. I'm going to cut off the possibility of going that way, and I'm going to go this way. And I'm going to ask for God's will. What's God's will? I thought Santa Claus God. If I get good, he'll give me what I want. That was my first definition. What I found out is that for me, God is the energy of love. If it's not the loving thing to do, if it's not the loving thing to say, if it's not the loving thing to think, it's not God's will for me. It's not about what God's going to give me. It's about how am I going to show up in this world. If I start living from that place, my life is going to change. And in the fourth step, I take that personal detailed inventory. And I start to get that courage to take a look at myself and my part in this process of life. What am I doing? I've got three-year-old coping skills at 25 years old. Hiding under the bed at 25 years old looks like I need mental health. Three, it worked great. Kept me from getting the shit beat out of me. So I gotta start looking at what's my part? How did I cope? How am I still coping with this feeling over here? How am I still doing that? I gotta clean that up and get new coping mechanisms. But I can't do that until I look at that. So I have to have the courage to look at that. And step five, I have to share that with another human being. Because I gotta start building some trust and some integrity in my life. And number five, integrity. I'm scattered, I'm everywhere. I take that 180 degree turn to integrity. I match my words with my actions and my actions with my words. I stop trying to be all things to all people and I start getting the integrity of being whole. And I'm still working on that today. And in step six, we become willing to allow God to fix this stuff in us. Because 95% of my thinking, I'm not even aware of. I'm running on the 5% that's making me want to drink because I can't stand how I feel because of the thoughts that I have that leads to the behaviors that are destroying my life and my body. And I don't have what it takes to fix that shit because I didn't even put most of that in there. A lot of it came from this family. They didn't want it either. But you can't give something you haven't got and you can't not give what you do have. Right? I couldn't not give my crap to my kids. We'll get to that in a minute. My parents didn't want that stuff either. This is family illness, generational, pass it on. The disease of shame projected onto the next generation. We accept it because that's the way human beings are set up. We love them so much, we'll take on the load and carry it forward. And the people who end up in rooms like this with people like you, we get to clean it up together because we became aware. And we humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. We stay willing because it's going to take a while. Didn't happen in a day. It's not going to clean it up in a day. I used to think that all my defects of character, that God should just come down here and remove them all. And then what I found out is that I need to do some character building so that I have some healthy coping skills to replace those unhealthy coping skills. He's not going to leave me flat with nothing to protect my internal world with. So he's going to let me hold on to those old ideas as long as I need them. And when they're too painful to hold on to anymore, that's when I'm going to let him go. And if I'm lucky enough to stay in these rooms, I'm going to do it with you. And love. We start repairing the relationships and the behavior. You know, step 8 is about self-love. I love myself enough to own it all. I own it all. I get to be imperfect and love myself anyway. And I start shifting out of shame, and I allow myself to feel guilty, which means I'm human and I made a mistake, and I'm still lovable. Because we have a solution for guilt. When we're wrong, we promptly admit it, we clean it up. I don't have a solution for shame except for alcohol or some other addiction. Shame is the fuel of addiction for me. And in 9, we take the discipline and we go clean it up. If I owe you money, I pay it back. If I lied to you and it won't hurt you to tell you about it, I take care of it. I have a funny story. I hope I can talk about this, Joe. So it was Joe's birthday, the day that we were going up to Idaho a couple weeks ago for some family graduations, and he's had this thing about, I got to see an amends happen right in front, like the completion of an amends right in front. This was the way my interpretation of it was. He had had this thing about cleaning up an amends in restaurants, right? So it was his birthday, and I gave him all these gifts. And it was just me and him because we're on the way to a family event. And he was having all the, because he had had terrible restaurant luck for years, right? And being married for all these years, like, we'd laugh about it. And he'd made all these financial amends for the shenanigans of his early years. And all of a sudden, we go to pay the bill. He's had this beautiful meal, and these people sitting next to us had recognized that it was his birthday and they paid his bill. And I realized, we don't know when our amends are done, but I felt like that was it for him, and I got to witness that, and I thought, that's amazing. God, let that be joyful. There's joy in amends. I dropped out of high school. I had a Mr. Holland's Opus music teacher who loved me, who poured his heart and soul into me, and I dropped out of high school with no regard for his feelings. And I made that amends. And when I sent that letter and I sent my first CD to him, he was so moved. And about 6 months later, I was given a grant by the state of California. Their arts council gave me a grant to teach songwriting to the kids in the continuation high school. There is joy in amends. Do not be afraid of your amends. There is beautiful love, not just for you, but for the people who benefit from your amends. The healing process is so painful at times, and yet it's so beautiful. Those are some of the examples of the amends that I've made and gotten to witness by being married to a person who works this program. I could go on and on about the amends that we get to make in this program, but I get to show up as a new person. And a lot of my amends have been living amends, and that's an important part of this program too. Patience and perseverance. 180 degrees turn. You know, I was not patient, and I was one of those really great beginners and terrible finishers. That was me. I get to be patient and perseverant, and when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it, and I clean it up, and I do better next time, and I continually work towards a higher version, a better version of myself, because I work to be in service. Step 11, this is where I try to live these days, because I think all the answers are in my connection to my higher power. And it says in the chapter to the agnostics, my very favorite chapter in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is that down deep inside, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. God's not out here. it's in here. My connection to that higher power is the most important thing to me in my life. And it is what keeps me sober. And it is what keeps me sane. There's nothing outside of me that can fix the God-sized hole that I had when I got here. So all that overcompensating behavior, little by little, started to shift and change. I got 20 minutes to really get there, huh? At least I'm sober. At least I got to sobriety. I work at that awareness because I know that so much of my thinking are things I get to clean up, because I believe in generational healing. It's not just that if I heal, good for me. I heal, I get to forgive my mom, my dad, my grandparents. And energetically, I think that counts. I'm not sure how it counts, because what I, and all my seeking, and all my seeking around God and trying to figure it out, I've come to this conclusion. And I've had some amazing spiritual awakening moments. I've been blessed, very blessed. God has met me more than halfway. He has come way more my way than I have his. And here's what I know about God, not much. I know that there is a God, I'm not it. I don't know much about him, but I know he knows everything there is to know about me. Everything. And loves me unconditionally. That I know, because I don't deserve it, but I get that love. Mm-hmm. And I know that's true about every human being that's ever lived. That's my belief. And then in service, we carry this message to those still suffering. I was not interested in being of service to anybody. That was a foreign concept. Gratitude and service were completely foreign concepts to me. But that's what we do here, and that's the fellowship. We carry the message. That's why we have meetings. We carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and the other 12-step programs that meet in rooms like Al-Anon Club or Alano Clubs. And the reason that's important is because then they say you can't keep it unless you give it away. And if you're in service, you're in the work. Because you teach what you need to learn. And as a sponsor, I want to talk a little bit about how this evolved for me. You know, about 18 years into my recovery, I realized one of my children was addicted to, I suspected, probably the worst drug out there, which turned out to be true, in my opinion. It was really hard drugs. And I started that battle of trying to save her life. And I was super having a spiritual crisis, really doubting God's, the fact that he was there. Why is this happening to me? Look at all I've done. Look at all the people I've sponsored. Wham, wham, wham. And I got to a bottom with that. And I ended up in Al-Anon because of the recommendation from a treatment center that she was in. And eventually she did get clean and sober, and she did end up getting her high school diploma, her master's, her BA, her master's degree, and she has a great job. She's married to a wonderful man, and she has a great, she's done really well, just had a baby. And what happened was, after all that Al-Anon saving her, and I really had to let her go to do that, and Al-Anon helped me do that. And I could not have done that without Al-Anon. Because if I didn't know powerless when I was struggling with it, I know powerless now. But I can't control alcohol in any container. And my daughter is another container. And it's not mine. So I had to go inward for me and clean my stuff up. And it brought up all my unresolved stuff. And then she got clean and sober and started living this great life. And I'm in the rooms and I'm sponsoring, like, I'm not kidding, 18 people at a time. And I'm so overcommitted and had no boundaries and couldn't figure out what was wrong with me and having resentments and all this stuff. And I got sick in the rooms because I wasn't taking my recovery to the next level and being realistic about who I am and what I need to be doing, because I didn't have the tools to do that. snuck down myself. I actually Googled, because I had these terrible delays of emotions. I would be pissed at somebody and find out about it next Tuesday. And that was a huge improvement from being pissed at somebody and finding out 3 years from now. So I thought I was doing pretty good. But it's really hard to respond in a healthy way when you're not having real-time feelings. And I didn't know what that was, and I was having a real big problem thinking I had to sponsor everybody that asked me, and just had my ego caught up in that, and the people-pleasing of that, and I still knew that she was doing great, and I wasn't. That's when I realized, wow. So I had this experience where I was super pissed at this person about a week and a half later after an incident. Like, I found out about it by driving by the building. I went, oh, I can't believe he said that to me. And like all this feeling, I went, what is this? And I Googled it. Here I am in AA in Al-Anon all these years. I Google it. What is delayed emotional reaction? You know what came up on the Google? CODA. Codependence Anonymous and the 5 patterns of behavior. And it was number 1, denial. I felt like somebody took a hammer and just hit me right between the eyes. So I started going to CODA, and I met some of these beautiful ladies that are here today from Walnut Creek. And I started bringing some of my friends over there. And I started healing those core patterns of behavior that I learned to survive in my family of origin. And this is not a shame. This is not blaming anybody. Nobody wants this stuff, you guys. But the first one aware gets to work on it. So I start working on the pattern of denial. And there's this pamphlet encoded that says, it's a communication pamphlet, and it starts describing how we communicate. And there's like, are you using weasel words? And I thought, I think I'm the queen weasel. And like, I mean, I just totally recognized all this. And I was like, oh my God, this is so me. Oh my God, this is me. I actually did an inventory of the 5. I went, oh, I'm totally doing that. Oh, I'm totally doing that. And they seem contradictory at times, but I went, oh my God, all of this is why the, like, I've done lots and lots of 4-step inventories, and I still kept coming up with some of the same stuff, and I'm waiting for God. Hey, you know, 6, I'm really willing. You're willing when you're willing to go to any lengths to keep working on the interior of your world so that you can live comfortably, so you don't feel like you want to drink, for one, overeat, or blame and shame everybody else around you. That's what I learned about me. So I'm starting to work on this CODA stuff, and I start realizing, I don't know how to put I think, I feel, I need together. I have no idea what I thought. It wasn't safe to express an opinion in the family I grew up in. Nobody cared what I thought. They were going to tell me how it was. Feeling? Oh, you got hit for that. You got a feeling? I'll knock that out of you. We don't do feelings. We kill feelings. There's one person in the family gets to do the feelings. That's the designated hitter. That's it. You don't want to do a feeling around him because he'll hit you. That's what I grew up with. So I don't want to do feelings. Need? What do I need? I have no idea what I need. Because how can I know what I need? If I don't know what I think and I don't know how I feel, how can I possibly get that need met in a healthy way? So I'm getting my needs met in unconscious, unhealthy ways. And I recognize that. And I start doing the work of Codependence Anonymous. And let me tell you, now I'm down in the foundation of this house. And it's not fun. And it is absolutely worth it. It's hard because you're changing a foundation in a house you're living in. And the relationship shifted. And I had to stay present and work on me. I had to let go of a lot of that sponsorship stuff and let other women sponsor people and work on me and be honest about that. And I did that. And I still am doing that. I sponsor very few people right now for that very reason. And that took me to deeper work around emotional intelligence and emotional literacy. And, you know, Bill Wilson talked about emotional sobriety in some of his last writings. And he said, you know, we only know a little bit about this thing. We know it's a thinking problem that ends up being a body problem. And he started talking about all the things that they ended up writing about in the in these other 12-step programs later. And I think he'd be happy with what happened there. I have a feeling he would. And there's so much, there's so many good tools in that program for people who are ready to do that work and need to do that work. I didn't know I needed it. I was 20 years sober by the time I got to that point. And I celebrated 35 years of sobriety this last October. So the last 15 years have been not so much about, you know, the drinking thing. It's what's going on inside my world, inside of me. And I'll just bring you current and I'll tell you what I'm doing today. I at 7 years of sobriety, I started writing songs again. I was totally shut down creatively. And those songs were about my life. And those songs started getting heard by people. And pretty soon I started getting asked to sing here and sing there. It was all right around here. And then pretty soon I started getting asked to sing and, you know, at the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. and in front of the White House and for this group that was doing this and this group was doing that. And down in Los Angeles for tributes to people who'd written books. And I started meeting all kinds of influential people. And I got asked to serve as an advocate and a person who helps share the message around that recovery in its broadest sense of the word works. And take that message to the people who make the decisions around the money that's spent in insurance and mental health and the things that as taxpayers, because there's a lot of us and we pay taxes, and they need to know that recovery is something, we're not, this isn't a moral failing. Addiction's not a moral failing, it looks like one. It's a highly stigmatized thing to have. And because of that, we don't know how to get our needs met on a big social level. There's organizations out there that are addressing that and they asked me to join them as an advocate. And I currently serve on a board for Faces and Voices of Recovery. For some of you who've heard that. And I had to dig into those traditions and figure out how to do that ethically. Talk about my own personal recovery. I'd already been doing that because of music, and I had been working with my sponsor. I sat down with an archivist, talked about how do you do that? How do you be a public person talking about recovery without trampling the tradition of anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film? How do I do that? So I looked up the definition. I talked to people. I read the traditions, and I prayed about it, and this is what I came up with. Because I believe that our recovery isn't meant to just stay in these rooms. I believe whatever your gifts and talents are that God gave you, you need to take that out to the world. When you're really free, we can do that. But we still have to respect what got us here. So that was, I struggled with that for a long time. And what I found out was the definition of anonymity. It says we don't name and we don't take credit for. And so at the level of press, radio, and film, my name is Elizabeth Edwards. I'm a singer-songwriter from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. And when I'm in these rooms, I'm Lizzie. And I'm a person who's used the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and NCODA to heal a soul sickness through the spiritual medicine of the 12 steps. Thank you.